Strange New Years by Chychak, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Pike's Enterprise has a complicated reputation. What with all the chaos, the drama, the mysterious way it seems to be at the focal point of everything truly insane, yet somehow managed to get through the war with nary a scratch. But despite this, everyone in the fleet agrees that Captain Pike's New Year's party is absolutely the place to be when the clock ticks over into 0000 Galactic UTC. Pike denies it, of course, but he also welcomes everyone to his table and makes twice as much food as the number that RSVP, so read into that what you will. This year, the Enterprise and Farragut are on joint maneuvers near a nebula, and the promise of the published menu has got even Captain Reuben to quit his grumbling for once. The mission is due to conclude at 1600 GUTC, and Pike's doors open at 1800 precisely for cocktails. The only problem is that someone has to actually be in command of the Farragut while Pike's party is happening. The invitation says that Sid Reuben has 4+1s, and he has decided that Jim is none of them. "You eat at Pike's table every time you're there," Sid says, when Jim goes round to politely complain. "You have tomorrow off, and I know you'll be beaming over there to spend the time with your man, which is why I am taking the executive, nay, captainly decision that you are going to mind the shop in uniform while I go and eat canapes and drink champagne wearing my stretchiest pants." Jim cannot argue with this logic, but he is not about to let that stop him. He does lose fairly quickly because, unfortunately, command be like that, and he's in a filthy mood when he leaves the meeting, looks at his communicator to find a series of pad chat messages from Spock. Spock, what are you wearing tonight? Spock, before you answer, I do not mean this as a come on, but instead as a logistical query. Spock, I do not wish for us to clash. Spock wishes to send you an attachment, party outfit 1.png. Jim opens the file as he walks down the hall, and the noise of frustration that falls out of his mouth causes a nearby ensign to leap half out of her skin. Sadly, this is not a euphemism, and Jim apologizes profusely as he escorts the mortified ensign Zarea to sickbay to help with her premature shedding. The situation isn't made much better because McCoy is on duty, and he uses the best tool in his bedside manner arsenal, mocking Jim, to make the poor ensign feel better, and then drops the bombshell that he has managed to snag one of the captain's plus ones to the party. "Like today couldn't get any worse," Jim says, and leaves when McCoy shows Ensign Zarea the menu on his pad and asks her opinion on which dessert he should go for. By the time Jim finally is able to reply to Spock, his pad store is half full of blurry mirror selfies of Spock in various states of dress and, more excitingly, undress. JTK. Bad news. I pulled a short straw. I have command this evening. JTK. Just in case you need a reminder, though, I'll be wearing this. The picture he sends is his pouting face reflected in the window, wearing his command gold uniform. He does at least put a bit of a tilt into his hips when he does it. He's not an animal. Spock, this is disappointing. However, we will be seeing all of each other tomorrow. Spock, I will do my best to recover. JTK, try not to kiss anyone else at 0000, okay? Spock, I will do my best, but Captain Pike's chocolate lava cake martinis take no prisoners. The noise Jim makes at that mental image would honestly cause anyone to shed their skin had they been able to hear it. Thankfully, the turbo lift is empty and he manages to get himself back together in time to continue his rounds. It's not like the Farragut is a slouch on the party stakes, in her defense. And before Jim takes command at 1700, he makes a courtesy appearance at the official lower deck party, a decoy tradition that he used to organize in a former life. It's held in the enlisted mess to 20 solemn-looking sacrifices, and he beams with feigned command ignorance as he goes through the motions, handing out the joke awards, making some bad jokes that raise token laughs, and drinks some tepid alcohol-free champagne, all while everyone present politely ignores the unofficial party raging on in the suite next door. Jim takes pity on them eventually, and then checks the time and hurries off to the transporter room. He's unwilling to be a bad loser, of course, so he is there to give the excessively smug 5 lucky ticket holders a proper send-off to the Enterprise, and he smiles benignly as both Reuben and McCoy look visibly irritated at how pleased he is for them. "Wait for me," a voice calls out, just as Jim is about to transport them over, and Ensign Zaria, wearing a very pretty sequined sheath over her reattached skin, hustles on to the platform next to McCoy. "Hang on," Jim says. "And Benga owed me a favor," McCoy says smugly, "and Ensign Zaria was so excited about finally being able to try proper homemade human food, I couldn't help myself." Jim slaps his Starfleet smile on and slides the lever up until they dissolve into smug particles and beam over, though he does raise his middle finger to McCoy as he does it. He's not made of stone. 2200 arrives, and Jim lets all but a skeleton bridge crew go off to the party of their choice, choosing to keep watch himself. He smiles at them as they go and then slumps into the chair, flicking through his pad. The ship is at full stop, and the nebula outside the view screen, which was apparently so crucial to need to be investigated by 2 starships, turned out to be nothing more interesting than some inert gases caught in a subspace eddy. Yes, had they been more volatile, then this could have been something spectacular. But sadly, sometimes a cigar is just argon, neon, and helium. Space is fascinating and beautiful, and contains the capacity for everything in all of creation. But sometimes that is just a big fat load of nothing. The only interesting thing in the void tonight is the Enterprise and her flashing lights, as she hangs in space at a jaunty angle just in the corner of the view screen. In his chair, Lieutenant Serial yawns and then grimaces, looking back at Jim. "Sorry, sir," he says. "This is my first New Year's watch since the war." Jim smiles at him reassuringly. "No worries, Lieutenant. Just keep your eyes peeled for anything. Constant vigilance is our watchword." "It could be worse," Commander Adelaide, who is subbing in at communications, says. "Remember last year?" Jim laughs. "We were so itchy." "What happened?" Serial asks. Jim nods at Adelaide. "Someone on her crew brought back something from shore leave they swore was mistletoe, but it turned out to be something else that infested the ship and gave us all hives for a whole week." Serial giggles. "Oh man, that sounds bad." "It wasn't great," Jim says, "but it was at least better than the year before." "Oh my God, Cleodna," the lieutenant at tactical groans. "That was just embarrassing." She swings around in her chair. "We got hit by a weird cosmic ray that wiped our memories and scrambled the ship's logs for 3 hours. We spent the whole of the evening working out what had happened, running through every checklist, calling command to report our suspicions of body snatching, of a hole in space-time. But then it turned out that we'd been hit by a weird cosmic ray. Science has managed to descramble the logs. And we all watched as we all just sort of politely smiled at each other while waiting for someone to do something, which it turned out no one did. It was embarrassing." Serial raises his eyebrows. "Wait, no one trashed the place or had like an orgy or anything?" Jim shakes his head. "No." "Well, the yeomen did, but in the end, it turned out they were unaffected. They're just like that." Serial laughs. "Yeah, my yeoman year was wild." Nodding, Jim glances at his pad. 2220. His pad chat is blowing up, but he silences it with extreme prejudice. "I think I have the worst one, though," he says. "It was under Garavik during the war, and we just got the newest torpedoes installed, and someone told the tactical lieutenant at the ship's party that they were color-coded. So we were hiding in a supposedly dead area of space at the time, and morale was very low, And for some reason, the lieutenant got the idea in his drunken head that if he calibrated them just right, the ship could put on a fireworks show to cheer everyone up. So he did, without telling anyone. "Oh God, what happened? Did it not work?" Cleodna asks. "More like we suddenly had some furious Klingons decloak off our starboard bow. We'd scuppered their sneak attack. Half the crew were drunk and the other half were asleep, but nothing sobers you up like a red alert." "Wow," Cleodna says. "I mean, good for him, but also, what timing." "Wasn't that you?" Adelaide asks suspiciously, and Jim shrugs. "I managed to get both an official commendation and a demerit for it," he says proudly. "Youngest XO in the fleet, everyone," Commander Adelaide says sarcastically. "Aren't we lucky?" "We are," Cyril says, and Jim grimaces because that sounded way too sincere, and he's not drunk enough to deal with that right now. They continue polite conversation and minor calibrations for another hour and a half. During that time, Jim receives 112 messages from the girls' night group chat Ortegas added him to as a joke, 17 messages from McCoy, most of which are just bragging, 12 from Reuben, all of which are bragging, and 3 from Spock that he's saving for later. Spock has gotten very good at the off-duty message in the last few weeks, and Jim must be professional and not pop an erection in the chair. Again. "All right," Jim announces eventually. "It's 23:50. Time for you all to take your regulation 20-minute break. I don't want to see you again this year. Is that clear?" "Aye, sir," Adelaide, Cleodna, and Cyril say, tripping over themselves to run into the turbolift together, jabbering about which party is the best option as the doors open, and then they're gone and the bridge is silent, save the ping of the sensors and the hush of the atmospherics. Jim wastes the best part of the last 10 minutes of the year checking every single console is working and that all is well. He gets back into the chair and thumbs his notifications just in case anything important has come through, but the number has hit the point where the interface just gives up counting, so he just turns it over again and sighs to himself. The GUTC clock in the corner finally ticks over to 23:59, and Jim wastes 20 seconds trying to get the seconds to show up so he can further torture himself. At 23:59:33, he hears the turbolift whir a few floors below, and he hopes that someone, somewhere, is making a last-minute romantic dash to get to their sweetheart in time. He pulls his pad up and thumbs the connection to call Spock, but for some reason the call won't connect. "What the hell?" Jim mutters, and then jumps when there's the unmistakable sound of the transporter and someone behind him saying, "My apologies for being late." Jim stands and turns, his mouth gaping open in shock as Spock finishes shimmering into view. He's wearing a set of robes that look incredible, hunter green with wide sculptural shoulders and a close cut that emphasizes his trim figure, the whole thing with a contrast trim in unmistakable command gold. He has a delicate green flush on his skin and a champagne flute clutched in each hand. "I hope the transporter did not ruin the effervescence," he says, as he hands Jim one and then uses his newly free hand to pull him in. "You're right on time," Jim whispers, looking over his shoulder as the clock ticks into the last 10 seconds of the year. 5. Spock whispers, 4, 3, 2, 1, Jim says, as the clock chimes the new day and flips over to 0000 and kisses him right there on the bridge. The kiss is sweet, almost chaste, befitting this romantic nonsense of a situation. But Spock's hand is warm and his heart is fluttering against Jim's fingers where he clutches against his ribs. And when Jim breaks it and opens his eyes to the new year, Spock looks even more flushed and undone as when he last saw him nude. "Good party?" Jim asks, taking a sip of champagne, his fingers stroking any skin he can reach, which turns out to be Spock's left ear. "It was adequate," Spock replies, shivering, taking a sip of his own drink. "I did hope you would make an appearance. I even dressed so that we would match. How considerate, Jim says and kisses him again. We would have made a fine impression, I'm sure. Maybe next year, Spock says, downing his drink and putting the glass down on the arm of the command chair, taking Jim's face in his hands and making the kiss wet, luscious, and utterly filthy. Jim raises his eyebrows when he tastes chocolate on Spock's tongue and smiles, pushing his hands into his hair and pulling gently, and Spock moans and kisses down Jim's neck with intent. There are a lot of ways to celebrate the new year in space. And while there may not be Klingons this time, Jim's definitely seeing fireworks. When the crew return at 0020, themselves flushed and giddy with the joys of a new year, Jim is sitting primly in the chair, flicking through his pad with a satisfied smirk, confident that if he ever has to take New Year's watch again, at least he's got a story about getting to third base in the chair to keep him warm. The end.